Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to start today's program with a very important conversation about one of our most important nations, allies, partners, and vital interests, I would argue, as well, and that would be the state of Israel. There are a few people I know who are more thoughtful about these subjects, more informed, and a better communicator about what's at stake than our first guest. His name is Yoram Edinger. He is a man who has served in the foreign service of his nation, Israel, rising to the rank of ambassador. He served as a congressional liaison here in the Washington Embassy of the State of Israel for many years, and these days is a continuing and very influential contributor to the public policy debate, I would argue, on both sides of the pond, with his wonderful online resource, the Edinger Report. Mr. Ambassador, it's great to have you back at Securing America. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for this generous introduction and for the opportunity.
Thank you. You have been writing of late, as has been needed for many years, and you've risen to that occasion consistently, about terrorism. Terrorism in the state of Israel, terrorism in the region, terrorism as a threat to our vital interests, as well as those of friends like Israel in the Middle East. And I'd like you to start by talking about something we discussed a bit with a colleague of ours, Carolyn Glick, the other day, concerning this very ominous meeting. I think of it as a war council that Iran convened in Beirut, Lebanon recently. Who participated in that? What did you make of the meeting itself, and what has seemingly been flowing from it?
Well, this is another attempt by the Ayatollahs of Iran to expand their sphere all the way to the Mediterranean, namely Iran, Persian Gulf, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, all the way to the Mediterranean, while increasingly engulfing pro-US Jordan, or the Hashemite regime in Jordan. The Iranians consider their base or bases in Syria as a stepping stone to attempt and topple the pro-US regime in Jordan, which would further solidify the Iranians' position in that critical part of the Middle East. And if they succeed to topple the Hashemite regime, then they would continue through a domino syndrome into the Arabian Peninsula, notwithstanding the recent resumption of diplomatic ties with Saudi Arabia, a resumption which should not befog the reality of the vision of the Ayatollahs of Iran, which is roughly 1400 year old, and this is an anti-Sunni Arab vision. That vision stipulates the toppling of every single Sunni regime, primarily Saudi Arabia, and if they succeed to topple the regime in Jordan through their presence in Iraq, east of Jordan, and presence in Syria, north of Jordan, that would bring them very, very near the dominating position in the Middle East, which, by the way, is a very, very critical American issue, because we're not talking about terrorism that is limited to the Persian Gulf or limited to Lebanon or limited to the Middle East. We're talking about Iranian generated regional and global terrorism, which has access all the way literally to the US-Mexico border throughout Central America and South America.
Yeah, well, and I'm afraid north of that Mexico border as well. They are present in our country, as we've seen in the past. But almost certainly, as the Ayatollahs have been enriched in part by, you know, past American diplomacy, relief of sanctions and so on in connection with the so-called nuclear deals, we're watching them being emboldened by what's happening on the ground in the region, and not least the active support of communist China in all of this. So it's not just concerns about their nuclear ambitions that we need to be preoccupied with. It is also the extent to which they are now bringing to bear with increasing urgency, it seems, terrorism is one word for it. Jihad is another, of course, as you know so well, Mr. Ambassador. So when you look at this meeting in Beirut and the opportunities that now seem to be present for greatly ramping up Hezbollah's operations, including some rocket launches, as I understand it, into Israel recently. Gaza, of course, under Hamas, continuing to get support from the mullahs, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, its operations, you know, both in Gaza and, of course, in the so-called West Bank. You also have the Muslim Brotherhood in the mix, as I understand it, which brings in Turkey and Qatar. And, you know, this is a witch's brew of the first order, obviously. How serious a threat do you believe all of this represents most immediately to your homeland, the state of Israel?
Well, there's no doubt that this is a lethal threat with which we had to deal for many, many years. But once again, the issue transcends Israel. You were talking about emboldened Iranians. They are primarily emboldened by the erosion of U.S. posture of deterrence. Yes. They have been emboldened since taking over in February 79 by the U.S. diplomatic option, which has prevailed, has been sustained by the U.S. since then, in spite of the fact that this U.S. diplomatic option is mostly responsible for the expansion of the Ayatollah's clout in the Middle East and throughout the globe. The Iranians have been emboldened by the U.S. withdrawal, or more precisely, U.S. flight from Afghanistan. They have not missed an issue there, and they realize that it represents erosion of the willpower displayed by the U.S. And certainly the Iranians have been emboldened by the persistent embrace by the U.S. administration, along with the embrace by the U.S. administration of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the largest Sunni Muslim terrorist group, which threatens the survival of every single pro-American Arab regime. And last and not least, they have been emboldened by the U.S. pressure of pro-U.S. Saudi Arabia and pro-U.S. Egypt and pro-U.S. United Arab Emirates.
Yeah. Hold the thought, Mr. Ambassador. We're going to come right back with more on what all of that translates into in terms of intensifying jihadism against Israel and us. Stay tuned for more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If there were anything more to the so-called critical race theory than a leftist hustle to divide and subvert America, one might expect its adherents to be characterizing the relentless attacks on Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas as evidence of systemic racism against an oppressed black man. 40 years of mostly white progressives vilifying the content of Justice Thomas's character and his conduct demonstrate, however, that a conservative black public figure, especially a supremely accomplished one, is considered fair game for transparent racism. That was true of his first high-tech lynching at the hands of then-Senator Joe Biden, aimed at keeping him off the Supreme Court. And it is true of the one underway today, aimed at driving him from it. America is a far better country for Clarence Thomas's service, and we should all strive to be worthy of it. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are visiting with Ambassador Yoram Ettinger, a longtime diplomat for the State of Israel and a man who has special acumen when it comes to understanding the dynamic trends that are not only affecting his own nation, but our vital interests and indeed our security as well. And Mr. Ambassador, you were talking about this bit about the erosion, as you put it, of America's deterrence in the region. That now seems to be on full throttle as we speak, with the Chinese filling the vacuum of power that has been created by the Biden administration. I guess what I'm particularly interested in is your sense as to the problems that you've described, notably of Iran's ambitions, its desire still, notwithstanding this deal between the Saudis and the Iranians brokered by the Chinese, to topple the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They're working with the Muslim Brotherhood, which happens, as you've said, to be a Sunni group. Similarly, interested in overthrowing the Saudi royal family. We have the United Arab Emirates now in the mix in all of this turmoil. We have the Qataris enabling the Muslim Brotherhood and collaborating with Iran, the Turks and so on, all, you know, seemingly interested in intensifying the destabilization of the region. And I you and I have talked about this on a number of different occasions. I keep hearkening back to the Middle East upon the departure of Donald Trump from office and what a vastly better place it was than it is now. It seems to me that we're at the cusp of the region being engulfed in a conflagration, unlike anything we've seen perhaps in history, maybe as part of this larger war that is unfolding around the world. But talk a little bit about it, all of this, if you would, in the context of the Iranians now becoming a threshold nation, not exactly having the bomb, we're told, but capable of having it, and the adjustment that has been made by the United States government, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, saying the other day that, you know, we're good with that as long as they don't actually put the highly enriched uranium in weapons, deployed weaponry. This is a witch's brew of the first order, is it not?
Well, certainly, and a major fundamental mistake is to focus on the nuclear capabilities, because Iran's conventional capabilities, coupled with their very, very advanced ballistic technologies, has made them the number one threat to stability in the Middle East and throughout the globe. We're talking about a rogue element which senses weakness. And once you introduce weakness, you awaken the wolves. It only whets their appetite. The number one element of every nation's national security is posture of deterrence. And once you weaken your posture of deterrence, you only fuel, you add fuel to the fire, not only in the Middle East, but throughout the globe. We have seen recently the resumption of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The Saudis have been forced to do it by the US itself, because the US pressure on the pro-US Saudis while embracing the anti-US Ayatollahs and Muslim Brotherhood has pushed the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Egyptians closer to the arms of China as well as Russia, not only commercially, but primarily militarily, including, by the way, an agreement between China and Saudi Arabia to erect a nuclear power station for civilian purposes in Saudi Arabia. Some policymakers, some key policymakers in Washington have been misled to assume that gestures and compassion will change the mind of the rogue Ayatollahs, not realizing that as far as any rogue entity, certainly the Ayatollahs of Iran, any show of will to concede and retreat and appease and commit oneself to gestures is interpreted by them as weakness. Yes. Now, according to Western code of conduct, they may be wrong, but at this stage, they are the epicenter of anti-American terrorism. The Ayatollahs of Iran are the epicenter of proliferation of ballistic technologies, the proliferation of predator unmanned aerial vehicles, and again, all the way to Venezuela and Cuba and the drug cartels of Mexico and Colombia and Bolivia. And the chief factor behind the audacity of the Ayatollahs on the one hand and the need for the Saudis against their own will to come closer to China and Russia, the chief factor has been the premeditated erosion of posture of deterrence, premeditated by American policymakers.
Yes. No, I couldn't disagree with a single thing you've said, sir. And this is the thing that is so vexing about all of this. You understand the, you know, sort of psychology of those in the region. And it's absolutely palpable that weakness, irresolution, appeasement breeds vastly greater dangers. Not a lessening of them, especially when you're talking about people who believe that it is divinely ordained that they will usher in the golden age of Islam by bringing about essentially Armageddon. And that's pretty much, as I understand it, sort of the 12-er mentality of the Iranian regime. So just to tie this up, we have about a minute left, sir. What does Israel do in a circumstance like this, where the United States has at best been disengaging and emboldening our common enemies, and unfortunately alienating itself from Israel as well under the Biden administration?
Well, the Jewish state has always relied on its own capabilities. Obviously, we always welcome the partnership by our number one ally, the U.S., but we should rely on precedents. In 1981, the U.S. brutally pressured Israel against bombing Iraq's nuclear reactor, and we defied that pressure, and we spared the U.S., therefore, a potential nuclear confrontation with Saddam Hussein. In 2007, we were pressured against bombing the Syrian nuclear reactor. Once again, we acted the proper way and bombed the Syrian nuclear reactor, and we spared the Syrian people, the Middle East, and the U.S. a potential nuclear civil war in Syria. Yeah. We may have to do the same thing again.
We may have to help you, I hope, if you have to do that as well. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for your time today. Come back to us with updates soon, if you would. We'll be right back with you more right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Peter Husey. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute these days. He's had extensive experience in congressional branches of the U.S. government, as well as a lot of very important work over the decades since he left public office, advancing the understanding of the public, but also of our leaders about some of the most important issues of the day, specifically nuclear deterrence and what it takes to maintain it. Peter, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Frank, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be talking with you.
Thank you. I just had a conversation with Ambassador Yoram Edinger, a man we both know well. We were talking about this evolution of the status of the Iranian nuclear program, now acknowledged by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, as a threshold status, not supposedly full nuclear weapons capable, but certainly not still in the process of just preparing to have those weapons. The theory of the case is that as long as that enriched uranium they've been amassing is not put in weapons, we're okay. And we can have increasing dealings, perhaps, with Iran. That would be the position of the Biden administration, I think. What are your thoughts about this, Peter? Does it, in fact, make a dime's worth of difference, whether we call them a threshold nation or whether they actually have the bomb in terms of the threat that poses?
Whether, I would answer it two ways. If people in the region think they have the bomb but don't know, will they be intimidated to basically make a deal and not antagonize Iran and did Saudi Arabia move in that direction recently? Mm-hmm. The second question is, I think Iran virtually has warheads that it's built, but it wants to get rid of all economic sanctions. That's why they would like to say, hey, we're not a nuclear state. Why you have these sanctions on us? And once the sanctions go away, my concern is they'll announce and let people know they have nuclear weapons. Now, there's a third factor. I've always been told Russia and China have no interest in Iran having nuclear weapons because it's too dangerous. They don't know what they'll do with them. I think that's changed because Russia and China are now allied with Iran against us and Israel. And they're trying to coerce the other Arab nations in the region to basically come their way.
Right. I think that's all true. Yeah.
My worry is Iran has every intention to become a nuclear state. It's only a question of when they announce it. And then the coercion will be real. And then the countries are going to have to say, do we rely on the U.S. extended deterrent, or do we make deals separately because, well, you know, we're not quite sure America will come to our aid, even though we like America and all that. That, to me, is the same thing going on in Eastern Europe, same thing going on in the Pacific.
It's a matter of separate peace that they may be pursuing to try to lessen the risk that they're facing. And I guess, Peter, the only thing I would add to what you've just said is that capability, in my estimation, is there now. That weapon is in the hands of the Ayatollahs now. We can't say for sure, but I think that's got to be the working assumption. The question is not simply will they be coercing people by brandishing it at some point, but will they actually use it?
Well, then the question comes down is, remember Khomeini said Israel is a one-bomb country. He was told, well, won't Israel retaliate and destroy Iran? And he said, I don't care, because all the Jews will be dead.
The Jews will be dead. And as we were talking about a little bit with Yoram, if you believe that it is your divinely ordained duty to bring about the golden age of Islam by unleashing essentially Armageddon, something you care about, it's something you actually aspire to.
Is it? Yes, the Imam comes back only after Armageddon.
Right.
And then the ideology is crazy. Jesus Christ actually comes as Muhammad's and Allah's messenger to come in and sort out the bad guys from the good guys. You go to heaven, you go to hell. It's a little crazy. But
Christians and Jews, as I understand it, get the worst of that because they didn't embrace Islam.
Yes.
Peter, before we run out of time, I wanted to pivot to one of the places you mentioned a moment ago, Eastern Europe. Ukraine is, of course, a place where we've been hearing a lot of talk about nuclear war fighting. And mostly it's been coming from Vladimir Putin, and the threats, I think, are taken seriously by people like yourself, and properly so. You have written a couple of pieces, I think, at the Hudson Institute's platform about these nuclear threats. And, you know, might they be exercised, or might they work even in the absence of being exercised to coerce, as you say, the Ukrainians and the West into accommodation? Talk us through all that, if you would, quickly.
Well, the thing is, Putin's threats have said basically, okay, you can send weapons, but I don't want you to, and don't send very good weapons. On the other hand, we have agreed we're not going to send American or NATO troops or airplanes. So in a sense, his deterrent has worked, his threats, and in a sense, they have not stopped us from aiding in Ukraine. But there's something bigger going on. Why would he say, I'm going to send nuclear weapons to Belarus? Mm. Well, as I've written, he wants all theater nuclear weapons the United States has not only out of Europe, but he doesn't want us to bring the sea-launched cruise missile in because it can be in any of the ocean areas. So he wants to have he says, all mine weapons are on Russian soil. True, but they can reach all of Europe anyway. If these systems were on American soil, they could reach Canada and Mexico, which is, what's the point? However, there's another part of this, and it's China. China's worried that South Korea keeps talking about having nuclear weapons, American weapons on Korean soil, which we withdrew years ago, or their own. And the Chinese are very worried about that. So this gambit is, we don't have nuclear weapons, theater or otherwise, on other people's soil, but you, America, do. So you're the bad guy and we're the good guy. And
So how does that work with Belarus if he's putting them into foreign soil?
Well,
I know he considers Belarus basically a vassal state, but...
No, he's saying if you put them in England and Italy and so forth, I'm going to put them in Belarus.
I see.
But if you want me to not put them there, you have to take yours out.
Right.
Same thing as the SS-20s that the USSR put out there and said wanted to intimidate us to break NATO. And this is the whole point about the war in Ukraine was to break apart NATO.
Right.
Okay. And the same thing with having North Korea have nuclear weapons in the Pacific is to break the alliance between the United States, Korea, and Japan. Mm-hmm. What happened is the opposite, is they got better. They became better allies of us and asked us to strengthen our deterrent. The question is, where will we go? Okay. Yeah.
Well, just strengthening the deterrent, as you say, is something that this administration has not been all that keen on. I mean,
no, they don't.
Strategic forces are ongoing, but this theater business, they've been rather hostile to it. And Peter brings me back to something we talked about a moment ago. The separate peace, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's in the Far East, who knows, maybe whether it's even in Eastern Europe, is almost certainly going to be prompting countries that have thus far nestled underneath our extended deterrent to contemplate having their own deterrent. Is it not?
I also want to make it very clear, as a number of specialists and top former military people told me, our strategic nuclear deterrent, what we call the big stuff, mm-hmm. has always been instrumental as part of our extended deterrent. The issue is people have said, can you add to that, please? Which is theater, and our theater systems are only in Europe and only on airplanes and the gravity bombs. Mm-hmm. So we don't have cruise missiles and we don't have Navy-based cruise missiles, which are good to have because I don't have a problem with basing. I can put them in the air and they're okay. And the Russians and the Chinese wouldn't know where they are. Mm-hmm. So they can't target them.
Yeah.
So to me, you know what happens when you delay and kick the can down the road? You end up basically saying, I'm going to take me 10 years to get something done that I need in two. Or 6 months, or today.
Yes, so yesterday.
And there's nothing. You can't buy the time back that you lost. And so
that's for sure.
Okay, you're in this trouble. Go as fast as you can to where you need to go. Because, as you said, I can't buy that time back. And the bad guys get to vote. They're what they're going to do.
But, Peter, let me ask you this. Because, again, you're a specialist in these matters. Japan, South Korea, probably Taiwan, in my estimation. The Saudis, maybe, others, are in a position either to rapidly execute options they've put into place to have nuclear capabilities, or perhaps simply buy nuclear weapons from somebody else, maybe the Pakistanis, who knows.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that possibility? And is that something that, under these circumstances, we should actually welcome, despite its proliferation implications?
A recent colleague of mine, and yours, his friend, wrote a very good piece on this, saying the central nuclear issue of our time is threshold states becoming nuclear because they worry about their own security because of the threats from North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China. So they're stimulating this, what could be what President Kennedy worried about in 1962, this cascade of what Dory Gold wrote about, remember, and I also wrote it, but he called it his clock. A PowerPoint was that they're on a different clock than we are.
Yeah,
we're decades beyond there. So that to me is the gravest threat we now face. You can add Turkey to the list of folks. Now, Professors Mersheimer and Waltz said, "Oh, don't worry. If everybody has nukes, they'll all behave." See, mm-hmm. Pakistan and India behave, and France and England behave. They have nukes. And so my view is these countries have no clue as to how to handle nuclear weapons. They haven't, the new ones, okay? So it's going to be, we learned with the Russians and then the first Soviets and then the Russians, boy, it took a long time to develop a way where we feel comfortable. And this will not happen. This will be basically recklessness then becomes not
possibly provocative.
But what happened to these guys?
Peter, I have to leave it at that. We're out of time. Thank you for your thoughts on all of this.
Thank you.
We will be back to you with updates, needless to say.
Okay.
Take good care, my friend. Thanks for
what you
do with the Hudson Institute. Be well. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If there were anything more to the so-called critical race theory than a leftist hustle to divide and subvert America, one might expect its adherents to be characterizing the relentless attacks on Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas as evidence of systemic racism against an oppressed black man. 40 years of mostly white progressives vilifying the content of Justice Thomas's character and his conduct demonstrate, however, that a conservative black public figure, especially a supremely accomplished one, is considered fair game for transparent racism. That was true of his first high-tech lynching at the hands of then-Senator Joe Biden, aimed at keeping him off the Supreme Court. And it is true of the one underway today, aimed at driving him from it. America is a far better country for Clarence Thomas's service, and we should all strive to be worthy of it. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest, a dear friend, a valued colleague, and a freedom fighter par excellence, particularly on behalf of religious freedom. She is the director of advocacy for Catartismus, a group that is inspired by St. Paul's admonition to equip the faithful for their efforts to spread the gospel and the teachings of it and Jesus Christ. We're delighted to have her with us always, though the occasion for these conversations, this block and the next, is a rather grim set of developments in a country she has followed very closely, been to many times, worried about intensively, and that would be Sudan. We're anxious to get a take from Faith McDonald about what is going on there at the moment, what it means for the people of the country, including the people of the Nuba region of Sudan that has been long besieged and assaulted by the jihadists who have run Khartoum and much of the rest of the country. Afflicted the people of South Sudan. And Faith has been intimately involved in the birth of that country and its efforts to survive in a very difficult part of the world. Faith McDonald, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back to Securing America.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about sort of the background to the present crisis in Khartoum, and I guess it's now spreading elsewhere in Sudan as well.
Yes, this is Khartoum, of course, is the capital of Sudan, and the capital is where the government should be. Right now, there's no government in Sudan. There are two armies fighting each other for control of the country. It really seems as if Sudan has been cursed to be a country with bad leaders since the beginning. As you know, Omar el-Bashir took control in a military coup. So that started the military ball rolling back then.
That was decades ago, right?
That was. And when he was ousted in 2018, there were hopes, a lot of hopes. Me, not so much. Knowing Sudan the way I do, I have referred to myself as the skunk at the garden party because so many people, including our Christian friends, religious leaders, Tony Perkins had me on and asked me how excited I was about what was going on in Sudan. And I said, well, we'll wait and see. I've seen too many times that this happened.
Let me just ask you to, again, level set here a little bit. Bashir, of course, was a notorious, well, I call them Sharia supremacist,
yes.
A jihadist, if you will. And he imposed a Islamist administration that was not only brutally repressive internally to Sudan, but also supported terrorism elsewhere, including Osama bin Laden was in residence there for a time. The hope was, when Bashir was toppled, that a new secular government might emerge that would be both moderate and respectful of human rights. What happened to that idea?
Well, it was a great idea, but there was no power behind it. The man who had been chosen basically to be the civilian leader of Sudan, and I'm forgetting his name right now, but he Hamdok, he was a good man, and would have, I think, brought great changes to Sudan. Now, some changes did happen, and they haven't been reversed yet. But that civilian government has never happened. And again, this led to the coup that happened in 2021, when there was supposed to be a civilian government formed, and the military did another coup. And to these incidences that are going on right now, because there was a plan to move forward to integrate the Rapid Service Forces, which is the paramilitary group that's fighting against the Sudan armed forces, and to integrate them. And when you've got two egomaniac, evil generals, neither who wants to give up control, that's not going to happen. So that is what has led to what's happening now.
So inside Khartoum at the moment, these two elements, the Sudanese armed forces, and I think it's called the Rapid Support Forces, are now literally laying waste to the city in their efforts to establish control one over the other.
Yes.
There's talk about a ceasefire. There's talk about trying to broker some sort of settlement between the two. The State Department has set up some sort of task force to work the problem. Is there any prospect, Faith, knowing the country as you do, knowing these egomaniacal and Islamist generals, let's be clear, that they're going to come to some meeting of the minds and a peace that will alleviate the suffering of the people in the city and beyond?
Well, Frank, there could be a meeting of their minds, but I don't know that would really alleviate the suffering of the people. They could make a plan where, you know, one is in charge and the other's underneath, but it's going to continue Islamism all the time. The people of Sudan are tired of it. The Muslim people of Sudan are tired of it. You know, the Rapid Security Forces are based in Darfur. They were the Janjaweed who killed so many people in Darfur. And the people of Darfur and the refugees outside of Darfur are just miserable. And then the Sudan armed forces who are doing all this wrecking of Khartoum, looking for their rivals in people's houses and things. So it's attacks against civilians. And, you know, for me, one of the worst things that I've heard was that they burned the cathedral, the Anglican cathedral Khartoum, and have attacked all the houses of the leaders there.
Faith, hold that thought, because we're going to come back to persecution of Christians, among others, both in this country and beyond, with one of those who is standing for them handsomely, I might add. Faith McDonald. We'll be right back with more right after this. Welcome back. We're continuing a conversation about a country that may seem very remote in the Horn of Africa, Sudan. We're discussing it with a woman who knows it well and has anguished for decades on behalf of the people there who have been, well, terribly mistreated by successive regimes and are now in the midst of a civil war between two competing generals, both of whom want Sharia supremacism, to be clear, but they want to be in charge as well. And Faith, you were describing among the things that have been attacked in Khartoum in the midst of this conflict is the Anglican Cathedral. This raises the question of more broadly, what is happening to Christians in that country and others that are, you know, obviously not favored by one or the other of these Islamist generals.
Yes. Well, you know, we talk a lot, Frank, about the Nuba Mountains, because that is a place where Christians and Muslims, about 50-50, have lived together in peace. But then they were attacked, as you know, and almost wiped out during Bashir's time. Right now, things are pretty silent in the Nuba Mountains. And I believe it's because they have their own armed forces under Commander Abdelaziz, who the United States government has always criticized for not, you know, playing the game with all the other components of Sudan. But really, I think that people like Abdelaziz are the only hope for supporting and defending the citizens of Sudan. Mm-hmm. So the Nuba have been doing pretty well. In fact, the bishop of the Nuba Mountains just got back from baptizing 2,000 people, among them mostly Muslims and a few witch doctors as well. So they're building another whole diocese because there are so many churches, so many new priests. Wow. So that area, we can pray it will stay as peaceful as it is. But the rest of Sudan, it's really just terrible. Christians, of course, were promised that they were going to lift Sharia law, which, you know, I think they dangle out some carrots, and especially cynically for the world to see, for the UN to see, for the US government to see. I think really we failed. The government of the U.S. failed by wanting to integrate and be inclusive with every Islamist group instead of trying to find a real way forward, which we know has to do with the persecution of Christians. Because if you really believe in religious freedom, then you're not going to say that you want to include into the government, a new government, all these components who hate religious freedom, who only want radical Islam, and who will say anything that they need to say in order to get it, which I think is what happened with that so-called overturn of the government.
Faith, as you know, there are Muslims who are perfectly prepared, as you've described in the Nuba Mountains case, to live in peace with their Christian neighbors. Unfortunately, if you embrace Sharia, it is a supremacist program by definition, and all other religions, if they're tolerated at all, are, well, dhimmis, as they call them, and basically enslaved. So this is not a formula for the proper treatment, let alone respect for the religious freedom of minorities in the country. And Faith, just a quick word. We've only got a couple of minutes, but you follow this phenomenon of persecution of Christians worldwide. Our friends at Open Doors USA have undergone some name changes, but I think that the most recent of their annual reports indicated that there was something like 360 million Christians around the world who have been heavily persecuted, are being heavily persecuted, I should say. Do you think that's right? And what does that suggest in terms of others who are being less than heavily persecuted and the magnitude of this problem?
I definitely believe it's right, if not even a low estimate. and heavily persecuted. Yes, it's interesting to know what the conditions mean, because, you know, we know how heavily persecuted and murdered the Christians are in Nigeria, yes, with mass slaughter going on and on between Boko Haram and the Fulani, and a total disregard, if not cooperation, by the government of Nigeria, and now with the new president, even more to worry about. And and again, it's the persecutors, but it's also those who excuse them. We know that our government, USAID, the UN, they all use the excuse of climate change, that this is not a persecution of Christians in Nigeria. It's these poor herders looking for land for their cows. Of course, they have to slaughter all the people who live on the land. So, you know, that's severe, severe persecution. Now, in Pakistan, you've got people, Christians, who live in brick kilns as slaves for three generations of families. And I have been able to see on live stream the conditions in those brick kiln areas, and these people with tiny children who are going to grow up as slaves if nobody helps them. And praise God, there's a group that's helping to take people out of brick kiln slavery with as much as $130. For 28 years of slavery, they can be free for $130. So, you know, but Pakistan treats Christians like dirt. I mean, it's brick kilns with mud, and they're treated like dirt. They only have those kind of jobs.
Faith, this makes the larger point, and you are a founding member of our Save the Persecuted Christians coalition, for which I'm very grateful. And it's been trying not only to raise awareness about this horrific mistreatment of hundreds of millions of people just because they follow Jesus Christ, but also to make the point, and starting with our government, that we need to hold the persecutors accountable and penalize them for what they're doing here. There's got to be a change in the calculus that it's all upside to persecuted Christians if we're to see an end to it. God bless you and your work at Catartismos. Faith, it's great to talk with you. As always, we'll look forward to doing so again in the near future. Thanks to all the rest of you for joining us. Do so again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.